Cleft. On the surface of Cleft, a human weighed about as much as 3 pints of beer would weigh on Earth. Endurance weighed about as much as a couple of semi-trailer rigs. Ivy lit the ship's attitude control thrusters one last time and pivoted her tail up until it was vertical. Endurance was standing on her head, the torus aloft, iron hammerhead nose down on the iron floor of the crevasse. Dinah sent out some grabs to weld the ship to the asteroid. Ivy shut down the thrusters. Endurance was no longer a ship, but a building. From the hammerhead, now one piece of metal with Cleft, the stack ran straight up like the trunk of a tree. Various structures ramified outward from it like boughs. Its widest part was the array of 81 arclets that had formerly made up the stern of the ship. These now projected upward like leaves, or so they imagined. They couldn't actually go outside and look at it until they got out of the hammerhead. During the battle, they had sealed the hatch. By the time they had brought her to rest and welded her down, the rest of Endurance had been quiet for a long time. Finally, they opened the hatch and began to explore it one module at a time. They sent Buckies and Siwise out ahead of them to illuminate dark spaces and aim cameras into hidden corners. Tekla then went in, taking point, with Dinah and Ivy watching her back. They were armed with cudgels made from lengths of pipe, but they never had to use them. It was some combination of crime scene, battleground, and disaster zone. Only about half of the modules were still pressurized. Some of them had become completely isolated and could only be reached by a person in a spacesuit. It took days to get to them all. In one of them, they found Aida, the only other survivor from the Heptad. 2 days had passed since she had eaten the last of Tavistock prows, so she was very hungry, but otherwise in good shape. After becoming trapped by a combination of combat and bolide strikes, she had holed up in a water-filled storm shelter, then begun drinking its contents as she awaited rescue. The total number of living humans was now 16. Several had suffered injuries from combat or from the consequences of bolide strikes. Anyone who had not taken shelter in the hammerhead or in a storm shelter was suffering from radiation sickness. The healthy ones patched holes, repressurized modules, got the torus spinning again, and turned it into a sick bay, which filled up immediately. Dinah managed to get Dube out for one last spacewalk. He had been failing for days. Once they got him into the suit, though, his energy flooded back. Dinah took him out on the floor of the crevasse where he could walk, light-footed, with magnetized grabs latched onto his boots to keep him from floating away with every step. They rambled for about a kilometer, turning around every so often to look back at humanity's new home. Above the spinning torus, where Moira was even now unpacking her genetics lab, Tekla was inspecting the arclets on the top level, learning which were whole, which were beyond repair, and which could be patched up for future occupancy. On the floor of the crevasse, Grabs and Siwise were at work, rooting Endurance to her final resting place with spreading cables and struts. Where they walked, it was dark most of the time. That was the price of being sheltered from cosmic rays and coronal mass ejections. Looking up, however, they could see sunlight gilding the edges of the crevasse above them. They talked about how to set up mirrors that would bounce sunlight downward onto the arclets, which could grow food and scrub air in their translucent outer hulls. Dube spoke of endowment, the idea that, in time, a ceiling could be thrown over the top of the crevasse and walls built to keep in the air, whereupon a whole section of the valley could be given an atmosphere and turned into a place where children could go outside without the need for spacesuits. Then he walked home and died. They stored his body with the others In a damaged arklet that would serve as a mausoleum until such time as they could cut a grave out of Cleft's surface. That would take a long time. But the survivors all shared the conviction that, having sacrificed so much to make it here, they should be interred and not burned. Dube would share a grave with Zeke Peterson, Bowler Erdina, Steve Lake, and all the others who had died at about the same time. Some of those remained conscious long enough to relate the stories of what had happened to them during the conflict with the people who had come in from the swarm, and Endurance's final, hectic passage through storm and stone. Their counts were recorded and archived. One day, some historian would piece the story together, comparing it with data logs to figure out who had slain whom in combat and which module had gone dark when. Aida, of course, might have been their best source of information had she felt like talking, but she didn't. She had sunk into a profound depression, emerging from it at seemingly random moments to chatter about whatever stray thoughts were flitting through her head. No one wanted to talk to her. When she talked to you, she watched you too carefully with those avid, penetrating eyes, as if she saw, or imagined she saw, too deeply. It was impossible to be the object of that gaze without thinking of what she and the others had done, and without imagining that you were being sized up as food. An epic tale was told by the 3-year backlog of email, Facebook posts, blog entries, and other ephemera that filled up all of their inboxes as soon as the network of the swarm recombined with that of Endurance. The general arc of the story seemed to be a growing detachment from reality that had afflicted JBF and some of her inner circle. Louisa likened it to the growth of spiritualism after the First World War. During the 1920s, many who had not been able to bring themselves to accept the loss of life in the trenches and the subsequent influenza epidemic had fallen prey to the belief that they could communicate with their lost loved ones from beyond the grave. They had, in effect, sidestepped grief by convincing themselves that nothing had happened. The analogy was a loose one. The loss of life in the hard rain had, of course, been much worse. And few of the Arkies had adopted spiritualist beliefs per se. But after a particularly severe coronal mass ejection had slain nearly 100 Arkies, Tav had written a blog post about the journey he had made to Bhutan with Dube and the conversation that they'd had en route with the king concerning the mathematics of reincarnation. It was a meditative piece, a secular eulogy for those who had fallen. But in retrospect, it seemed to mark an inflection point in the survivors' thinking. The swarm had always had a sort of quasi-divine status to some, who had, perhaps, read too much chaos theory too superficially and were prone to believing that its collective decisions, lying beyond human understanding, partook of the supernatural. The mishmash of techno-mystical ideation that had grown out of that one blog post was unreadable and incomprehensible to Louisa or to anyone else who read it after the fact with a clear mind, but it seemed to have offered hope and comfort to many terrified young people trapped in arklets. Tav, to his credit, had backed away from any efforts to elevate him to prophet-like status. If anything, though, his modesty might have backfired. "I have no idea," Louisa said, "how anyone could read these threads and find hope in them, or even meaning, but they did, long enough to distract them from the real problems they were facing. And when Aida and the others finally came to their senses and began to push back against JBF and the others, the reaction was just that much more severe, because things had gone too far by that point. The backlash had started in a 2-triad bolo where a number of like-minded Arkies, including Aida, had called bullshit on the prevailing tone and substance of official statements emanating from the White Arklet and begun to denounce Tavistock Prowse as a puppet blogger for the regime. Dubbing themselves the Black Bolo Brigade, they had begun to spread their insurrectionist message to other Arklets in the swarm. That message, which made perfect sense as far as it went, was all about the need to face reality and to implement realistic, effective steps to address the swarm's problems. That included, if need be, throwing themselves on the mercy of endurance. They had demanded that JBF open the books and provide a current and accurate account of all stocks of water, food, and other staples, and how those numbers were changing over time. Julia had resisted those demands until the data had finally been leaked by a turncoat on her staff. The food picture had turned out to be bleak. This had led to a variety of responses that had determined the history and politics of the swarm ever since. Among some, a further retreat into mysticism and wishful thinking, based on a belief that the agent had been some sort of avenging angel sent by God, or by aliens so powerful that they might as well be God, to bring about the end of days and the merging of all human consciousness into a digital swarm in the sky. Among others, a frank embrace of cannibalism, in the sense not of killing people for food, but of eating those who had died of natural causes, as a stopgap measure until JBF could be toppled and replaced by people who knew what they were doing. The first group, the mystics, had tended to rally under Julia's banner. The cannibals had ended up under Aida, who, because of her intensity and her charisma, had gradually emerged as the leader of the Black Bolo Brigade. The one swarm had thus fissioned into two smaller ones, neither of which was as viable, and thereby worsened the same problems that had led to the split in the first place. From there, the story had been predictable enough, and had led to the events of the last few days. Aida still wasn't talking, but Julia was. According to her, Aida and the other Black Bolo survivors had calculated, in the last weeks, that their turn to cannibalism would be so repugnant to the survivors of endurance as to render them permanent outcasts. Rather than passively await the judgment, which they foresaw as extremely pious, sanctimonious, and punitive, of Ivy and her claque, they would seize part or all of endurance, beginning with her network, and then negotiate terms from a position of strength. This explained, at least in a general way, everything that had happened, save possibly for the physical mutilation of both Julia and Tav. Asked for a theory as to that, Julia shrugged. "We were criminals to them. Criminals need to be punished. It's hard to punish people who are already starving to death in a confined space. What is really left in the executioner's toolkit other than attacking the body? They wanted to silence me, and so they did. And they wanted to give Tav a taste of his own medicine by uploading his physical body into theirs." A week later, when the last of the victims had succumbed to their wounds, or to radiation sickness, 8 humans remained alive and healthy. Ivy called for a 24-hour pause to grieve and to take stock. She then called a meeting of the entire human race. Dinah, Ivy, Moira, Tekla, Julia, Aida, Camilla, and Louisa. They did not know quite what to do with Julia and Aida. For years they had dreamed, in idle moments, of one day bringing JBF to justice, whatever that would mean. Then, at the last moment, she had been eclipsed by Aida. And now it all seemed a moot point anyway. Could 6 women put 2 women in jail? What would it mean to be in jail in a place like this? Corporal punishment was at least a theoretical possibility, but Aida had already gone there with results that they all found sickening. JBF was a threat to no one. Aida still possessed an air of menace, but short of locking her up in an arklet, there was nothing they could do about that save keep an eye on her. And so they did, never letting her out of their sight, never letting her get behind them. They met in the banana, sitting around the long conference table. To one side of it was death. The sick bay where Zeke, the last man alive, had given up the ghost a day and a half ago, After making a joke about what a shame it all was, being the only man alive with 8 women to choose from. They had scrubbed the place down with bleach and made the beds with clean sheets in hopes that none of them would be occupied for a long time. To the other side was life, the series of compartments where Moira had been setting up her genetics lab. The meeting would later be known as the Council of the Seven Eves, for though 8 women were present, one of them, Louisa, had already gone through menopause. Ivy opened with a report on their general situation. From a certain point of view, this was surprisingly good. They had grown so inured to terrible news that she had to emphasize this more than once. Few places in the solar system were as safe as the one where they had come to rest. No cosmic radiation could touch them here. From coronal mass ejections, they were equally immune. Sunlight for energy and agriculture could be had a short distance above them, high on the walls of the crevasse, where the sun shone almost all the time. In the meantime, their big reactor, as well as 4 dozen arclet reactors, were producing far more power than they could ever use, and would continue doing so for decades. Of water, they still had 100 tons left over. While melting and splitting the water they'd used for propellant, they had extracted from it many tons of phosphorus, carbon, ammonia, and other chemicals left over from the dawn of the solar system that had once cloaked Greg's skeleton in a reeking black carapace. That stuff, as Sean Probst had well known, would be priceless as nutrients to support agriculture. They no longer had to worry, ever again, about the things that had been their obsessive concerns for the last 5 years. Perigees, apogees, burns, propellant, movement of any kind. No bolide could touch them down here. Even if Cleft banged into an equally large rock at some point, they would probably survive it. The vitamins that had been packed into every arclet launched up into the cloud arc had been intended to support a population of thousands. Even though many of these had been lost, what remained was still more than enough to keep a small colony in aspirin and toothbrushes for a long time. They were dependent, in many ways, on digital technology. They could not long survive without robots to do work for them and computerized control systems to keep the installation running. They had no ability to fabricate new computer chips to replace the old. But the architects, anticipating this, had stocked them with a large surplus of spare parts that would last for hundreds of years if husbanded carefully. And they had plans for rebooting digital civilization later. They had tools for making tools for making tools, and instructions on how to use them when the time came. With immediate needs accounted for, the discussion turned toward the obvious problem at hand. All heads turned toward Moira.
"My equipment made it through perfectly unscathed," she said. "The last 3 years have been boring for me. I have been treated as a fragile flower. I have spent the time writing up everything I know about how to use that stuff. If I drop dead of something tomorrow, you'll still be able to work it out. Obviously, we're all women. 7 of us are still capable of having babies, or, to be specific, of producing eggs. So, where can we get some sperm? Well, 97% of what was sent up from Earth was destroyed in the disaster on the first day of the hard rain. What survived, survived because it had already been distributed among 10 different arclets. All 10 of those later ended up going off with the swarm. None of that material, however, seems to have made its way here."
Aida interrupted. Staring across the table at Julia, she announced,
"I was in the swarm, as you know. I can tell you that this fact of the samples in the 10 arclets was forgotten, never discussed. If anyone even knew they were there, they forgot about it soon."
Julia was construing this as an attack on her record. "We had 800 healthy young men and women from every ethnic group in the world."
"Had," Aida repeated. "We had.
The amount of effort required to keep a few sample containers deep frozen wasn't worth the... Stop, Ivy said. If we can start making babies, their great-grandchildren can pore over the records and make judgments and have debates about what should have been done. Now isn't the time for recriminations.
I was in the meeting where Marcus called bullshit on the Human Genetic Archive, Dinah said. She was mildly amazed to hear herself backing Julia's side of the argument.
We can't make the same mistake again, Aida said, of fooling ourselves, believing in shit that isn't real.
Ivy said, had we known that it was going to come down so suddenly to 7 surviving fertile women, we would have had every healthy male masturbating into test tubes for the last 3 years. We'd have looked for ways to keep it all frozen, but we never imagined it would come to this.
It's not clear what the quality of the results would have been, Moira put in. Given the amount of radiation exposure, I probably would have had to do a lot of manual repair on the genetic material in those samples.
Manual repair? Julia asked.
I should put that in scare quotes, Moira said, reaching up with both hands and crooking her fingers. Obviously, I'm not literally using my hands, but with the equipment in there...
She tossed her head in the direction of the lab.
I can isolate a cell, a sperm or an ovum, and read its genome. I'm skipping over a lot of details, obviously, but the point is that I can get a digital record of its DNA. Once that's in hand, it turns into a software exercise. The data can be evaluated and compared to huge databases that shipped up as part of the lab. It's possible to identify places on a given chromosome where a bit of DNA got damaged by a cosmic ray or radiation from the reactor. It is then possible to repair those breaks by splicing in a reasonable guess as to what was there originally.
It sounds like a lot of work, Camilla said. If there's anything I can do to ease your burdens and make myself useful, I am at your disposal.
Thank you. We will all be working at it for months, Moira said, before anything happens. We have very little else to do.
Excuse me, but what is the point of discussing this, since we have no sperm to work with?
Aida said.
We don't need sperm, Moira said.
We don't need sperm to get pregnant. This is news to me,
Aida said with a sharp laugh. Moira went on coolly.
There is a process known as parthenogenesis, literally virgin birth, by which a uniparental embryo can be created out of a normal egg. It's been done with animals. The only reason no one ever did it with humans is because it seemed ethically dodgy, as well as completely unnecessary, given the willingness of men to impregnate women every chance they got.
Can you do it here, Moira? Asked Louisa.
It's not fundamentally more difficult than the sorts of tricks I was just describing in the case of repairing damaged sperm. In some ways, it would actually be easier.
You can get us pregnant.
By ourselves, Tekla said. Yes, everyone except Louisa.
I can have a child, of whom I am both the mother and the father, Aida said.
The idea clearly fascinated her. Suddenly, she was no longer the prickly, brittle Aida, but the warm and engaged girl who must have charmed the powers that be during the casting of lots.
It will take some tricky work in the lab, Moira said, but that is the whole point of having brought the lab safely to this place.
They all pondered it for a bit. Julia was the first to speak up.
Stepping into my traditional role as scientific ignoramus, do you mean to say that you can clone us?
Moira nodded, not to say yes, but to say I understand your question.
There are different ways to do it, Julia. One way would indeed produce clones, all offspring genetically identical to the mother. This isn't what we want. For one thing, it would not solve our basic problem, the lack of males.
Camilla's hand went up.
Moira, clearly annoyed by the interruption, blinked once, then nodded at her.
Is it really a problem? Camilla asked.
As long as we have the lab and can go on making more clones, would it really be such a bad thing to have a society with no males, at least for several generations?
Moira silenced her with a gentle pushing movement of one hand. That's a question for later. There is another problem with this version of parthenogenesis, which is, again, that all offspring are the same, exact copies. To get some genetic diversity, we need to use something called automictic parthenogenesis. Look, it's a long story, but the point is that in normal sexual reproduction, there is crossing over of chromosomes during meiosis. It's a form of natural recombination of DNA. It's what causes your children to look sort of like you, but not exactly like you. In the form of parthenogenesis that I am proposing to use, there would be that crossing over, an element of randomness.
And both boys and girls?
Dinah asked.
That's harder,
Moira admitted. Synthesizing a Y chromosome is no joke. My prediction is that the first set of babies, perhaps the first few sets of them, will all be female, because we simply need to get the population up. During that time, I can be working on the Y chromosome problem. Later on, I hope that some little boys will result.
But these little girls, and later the boys, will still be made out of our own DNA?
Ivy asked.
Yes.
So they'll be quite similar to us genetically.
If I do nothing about it, Moira said, they'll be like sisters. Perhaps even more similar than that implies. But there are a few tricks that I can use to create a wider range of genotypes out of the same source material. Perhaps they'll be more like cousins. I don't know. It's never been tried.
Are we talking about the inbreeding problem? It sounds like it, Dinah said.
Loss of heterozygosity.
Yes, I happen to know something about it. It's why I was chosen as a member of the general population.
Because of your work on black-footed ferrets and so on,
Ivy said.
Yes, this is a closely analogous problem. But the point I would like you all to keep in mind is that we solved that problem in the case of the black-footed ferrets, and we are going to solve it again.
She said it with force and confidence that silenced the others for a few moments and left them looking at her for more. Moira went on.
I think we all have at least an intuitive understanding of this, yes?
That one was aimed at Julia, who looked mildly peeved and bit off the following.
My daughter had Down syndrome. That is all I will say.
Moira acknowledged it with a nod, then went on.
Everyone has some genetic defects. When you are breeding more or less randomly within a large population, there's a tendency for those errors to be swamped by the law of averages. Everything sort of works out. But when two people sharing the same defect mate, their offspring is likely to have that defect as well. And over time, we see the usual unpleasantness that we all associate in our minds with inbreeding.
So, Louisa said, if we follow the plan you have laid out and begin a few years down the road with seven groups of what amount to siblings or cousins,
it's not enough heterozygosity to answer your question, Moira said. If you have a genetic predisposition to any disease, for example,
alpha thalassemia runs in my family,
Ivy said. That's a fine example, Moira returned. As it happens, Old Earth compiled vast databases on such things before its destruction, all of which are in there now.
She gestured in the direction of her lab.
We have a very good idea which defects on which chromosomes are responsible for alpha thalassemia. If you supply me with an ovum, I can find those defects and I can fix them before we begin parthenogenesis. Your offspring will be free of that defect. Barring some random future mutation, it'll never return.
Dinah raised her hand. My brother was a carrier of cystic fibrosis. I haven't been tested.
Julia raised hers. Three of my aunts died of the same form of breast cancer. I've been tested. I know I carry that defect as well. The same answer applies in all of these cases, Moira said. If there's a genetic test for it, then it means, by definition, that we know which defects are responsible for it. And knowing that, we can perform a repair. A new voice joined the conversation.
How about bipolar disorder?
Everyone looked at Aida. She would live out the rest of her life and go to meet her maker without having a friend or even a friendly conversation. So no one was in a receptive frame of mind about her question. But the mere fact that she'd asked it suggested a level of introspection they hadn't seen from her before. Moira considered it. I would have to do some research. I think that it does run in families to some extent. To the extent that it can be traced to particular locations on particular chromosomes, it can be treated like any other disease, Moira said.
Do you believe it should be?
Aida asked. Everyone looked automatically at Louisa, who nodded. We are long past the point of thinking of mental illnesses as somehow a lesser kind of disease than physical. Such disorders should, in my opinion, be addressed in just the same way.
Do you believe it must be?
Louisa colored slightly. What is the point of these questions, Aida?
I have done research on it, Aida said. Some say that bipolarity is a useful adaptation. When things are bad, you become depressed, retreat, conserve energy. When things are good, you spring into action with great energy.
And your point is,
will you treat this condition in my offspring against my will? What if I want to have a lot of little bipolar kids?
In the flustered silence that followed,
Camilla spoke.
What about aggression?
Everyone turned to look at her, as if unsure they had heard her correctly.
I'm serious, she said.
She looked toward Aida.
I don't mean to trivialize the suffering that your condition causes, but over the course of history, aggression has caused a far larger amount of pain and death than bipolar disorder or whatever. As long as we're fixing those aspects of the human psyche that lead to suffering, should we not eliminate the tendency to aggressive behavior?
That's different,
Moira began, but she was interrupted by Dinah.
Hold on a sec, Dinah said. I'm aggressive. I always have been. I was on track to be an Olympic soccer player. That's the only way I've ever been able to amount to anything, by channeling my aggression into doing things.
She nodded across the table at Tekla.
Hell, look at her. How many times has she saved our asses by being aggressive?
Tekla nodded.
Yes. Dinah saved me by taking aggressive action against rules of space station. Problem is not aggression. It is lack of discipline. A person can be aggressive, she nodded at Dinah, and still be constructive in society if she controls her passions.
And she threw a significant look at Aida, who let out a little snort and looked away.
So you're suggesting we breed people for discipline and self-control? Ivy asked. I'm not sure if I follow.
I believe that Camilla was merely saying that certain personality types, taken to an unhealthy extreme, are as bad as diagnosable mental illnesses per se, if not worse, Julia said.
I don't want you to speak for me,
Camilla said.
Please do not speak for me any more, Julia.
I am merely trying to be helpful, Julia said. But where the old JBF would have said it reproachfully, the new one merely seemed exhausted. Dinah broke in.
Well, what I am trying to say is that I don't appreciate being labeled as a genetic freak that needs to be eradicated from the human future.
No one would say that of you, Dinah, Ivy said. Camilla's talking about the knuckle-draggers who tried to kill her for wanting an education.
And what is your opinion?
Tekla asked Ivy. Similar to yours. Aggression is fine. It needs to be controlled, directed, but the way to do that is through intelligence, rational thought. That elicited a cackle from Aida.
Oh, sorry, she said. I was thinking about the swarm. 800 people, all carefully hand-selected for intelligence and rational thought. In the end, all we could think about was how they tasted.
None of us ate each other, Ivy said.
But you thought about it,
Aida said with a smile. Dinah slammed her palm hard on the table. She sat still for a moment with her eyes closed tight, then stood up and walked out of the room.
I guess she is not disciplined or intelligent enough to control her aggression,
Aida cracked.
It is a form of self-discipline, Tekla said, so that she would not kill you. You see, Aida, thinking about doing such things and doing are different. This is why greater discipline is a requirement.
Sweetie, what do you mean when you speak of discipline? Moira asked. I'm just trying to cash that word out in terms of genetics. I can find a genetic marker for cystic fibrosis. I'm not sure if the same is true of discipline.
Some races are disciplined, is fact,
Tekla said.
Japanese are more disciplined than Italians.
She gave Aida a stare that would have frozen most people to their chairs, but Aida just threw her head back and laughed exultantly.
You are forgetting the Roman legions, but please, go on.
Men are more disciplined than women, is just fact. So there must be genes for it.
This produced yet another silence, eventually broken by Louisa. I'm seeing a side of you I didn't know about, Tekla.
Call me bad. Call me racist if you want. I know what you will say. That it is all training. It is all culture. I disagree. If you do not feel pain, you do not respond to pain and hormones.
What about hormones, lover?
Moira asked. Her affection for Tekla was obvious and took some of the tension out of the room.
We all know that when hormones are a certain way, emotions have big impact. Other times, not so much. This is genetic.
Or maybe epigenetic. We really don't know, Moira said.
Whatever, Tekla said. My point is that for people to live in tin cans for hundreds of years requires order and discipline. Not from above, from within. If there is a way to make this easier with your genetic lab, then we should do it.
Louisa said, We never explored Ivy's point that intelligence was key.
Yes, Ivy said, with a glance at Aida. I was interrupted.
Aida covered her mouth with her hand and sniggered theatrically. Ivy went on. If we are really going to open the door to genetic improvement of our offspring, then it seems obvious to me that we should look to the one quality that trumps all others, and that is clearly intelligence.
What do you mean it trumps all others? Louisa asked.
With intelligence, you can see the need to show discipline when the situation calls for it, or to act aggressively, or not. I would argue that the human mind is mutable enough that it can become all of the different types of people that Camilla, Aida, and Tekla have been describing. But that's all driven by what separates us from the animals, which is our brains.
There are many different types of intelligence, Louisa said.
Ivy gave a little shake of her head. I've seen all of that stuff about emotional intelligence and what have you. Okay, fine. But you know exactly what I'm talking about. And you know it can be propagated genetically. Just look at the academic records, the test scores of the Ashkenazi Jews.
Speaking as a Sephardic Jew, Louisa said, you can imagine my mixed feelings.
We need brains, is the bottom line, Ivy said. We're not hunter-gatherers anymore. We're all living like patients in the intensive care unit of a hospital. What keeps us alive isn't bravery or athleticism or any of those other skills that were valuable in a caveman society. It's our ability to master complex technological skills. It is our ability to be nerds. We need to breed nerds. She turned to look at Aida full in the face. You ask for realism. Your complaint about her, she nodded at Julia, and the people around her was that they were holding out panaceas, not facing facts. Fine. I'm giving you facts. We're all nerds now. We might as well get good at it.
Aida shook her head in derision.
You completely leave out the human component. It's why you are a bad leader. It's why you were replaced by Marcus, when wiser people than you were in control. And it's why we are here.
Here, safe and sound, Ivy said. Unlike the people who followed you, all of whom are dead.
So they are, Aida said, and I am alive, and I can see how it's going to be. You are going to keep Amiya locked up in an arklet, making genetic freak babies and taking them away from me.
And she broke down weeping.
She has what I have, except worse,
Julia explained. She sees many outcomes, most of which, given the circumstances, are dark, then acts upon them.
What an unusual degree of introspection from you, Julia,
Moira said.
You have no concept of my level of introspection,
Julia shot back. I have been clinically depressed for most of my life. I once used drugs to fix it. Then I stopped. I stopped because I decided they were making me stupid, and I'd rather be miserable than stupid. I am what I am.
Depression is genetically based, to some extent. Would you like me to erase it from your children's genomes?
Moira asked.
You heard what I said, Julia answered. You know now the decision I made, which was to suffer for the greater good, because society will go astray if there are not those who, like me, imagine many outcomes. Let those scenarios run rampant in their minds. Anticipate the worst that could happen. Take steps to prevent it. If the price of that, the price of having a head full of dark imaginings, is personal suffering, then so be it.
But would you wish that on your progeny?
Of course not,
Julia said. If there were a way to have one without the other, the foresight without the misery, I would take it in a heartbeat.
We only need a few people of this mentality, Tekla said. Too many, and you get the Soviet Union.
I am 47, Julia said. I have one baby in me, if I'm lucky. The rest of you can punch them out for 20 years. Do the math.
It amazes me that we have already gone over to the competitive angle,
Camilla wailed.
I am so sorry that I brought this topic up.
A sharp rapping noise brought the room to attention. Heads turned toward the banana's window. It was not large, about the size of a dinner plate. For 3 years it had been buried in ice and forgotten about. But now it afforded a clear, if somewhat dizzying, view of their surroundings. Outside of it, carabinered to the spinning torus, was Dinah. She had put on a spacesuit and gone out through an airlock. Seeing she had their attention, she reached up and slapped a small object onto the glass. It was a lump of clay, some wires, and an electronic gadget. She depressed a button on the gadget, and it began to count down from 10 minutes. Aida screamed with laughter and clapped her hands.
What on earth is she doing? Julia asked.
That's a demolition charge, Ivy said. It's going to kill us all 10 minutes from now if she doesn't take it off the window.
She turned to survey the room.
Well, what is her point?
Julia demanded. I think my friend is trying to tell us that if we can't settle this in 10 minutes, the human race doesn't deserve to go on existing, Ivy said. They all sat silently for perhaps half a minute before Moira said,
How's this? Every woman decides what is going to be done with her eggs.
Hearing no objection, she continued,
Oh, let me be clear. If it's a real disease, something on the books, defined in the medical literature as such, then I will fix it, with no distinctions made between physical and mental disorders. No matter how many of those conditions each of you may be suffering from, I will fix them all before taking any other action. However,
and she smiled and held up an index finger,
Once all that is done, each of us gets a free one.
Free what?
Tekla asked. One alteration, one improvement, of your choice, applied to the genome of the fertilized ovum that will grow into your child. And your child only. You cannot force it on any of the others. So, Camilla, if you think it would improve the human race to get rid of its aggression, why then, I will search through the scientific literature for a way to reach toward your goal genetically, and likewise for the rest of you, and whatever changes you happen to think will improve the human condition. Your child, your choice.
They all considered it, glancing at one another from time to time, each trying to gauge the other's reactions. Ivy glanced at the timer outside.
Are there any questions? We have 8 minutes remaining.
Louisa said, I don't think we need 8 minutes. Ivy looked each of them in the eye, then turned toward the window and gave a thumbs up. Dinah's eyes, seen through the glass of the window and the dome of her spacesuit's helmet, pivoted to focus on that. She nodded. Moira smiled and put her thumb up. This, too, was noted by Dinah. Then Tekla, then Louisa,
Camilla,
Julia. All eyes were on Aida. She would not look back at them. She was, at bottom, very shy.
Whatever, she mumbled.
She needs to see your vote,
Ivy said.
Really? You mean that I could single-handedly destroy the entire human race simply by not putting my thumb up in the next 7 minutes?
Tekla pulled a folding knife from a pocket in her coverall and flicked the blade open. She kept it low, down in her lap, and pretended to clean a fingernail with it.
Either that, Tekla said, or population of human race suddenly goes from 8 to 7, and we have unanimous decision.
Smiling, Aida thrust her hand out, thumb down.
I pronounce a curse, she said.
Louisa let out an exasperated sigh.
This is not a curse that I create. It is not a curse on your children, no. I have never been as bad as you all think that I am. This is a curse that you have created by doing this thing that you are about to do. It is a curse upon my children, because I know. I see how it is to be. I am the evil one, the cannibal, the one who would not go along. My children, no matter what decision I make, will forever be different from your children, because make no mistake.
What you have decided to do is to create new races.
7 new races. They will be separate and distinct forever. As much as you, Moira, are from Ivy. They will never merge into a single human race again, because that is not the way of humanity. Thousands of years from now, the descendants of U6 will look at my descendants and say, Ah, look! There is a child of Aida, the cannibal, the evil one, the cursed one. They will cross the street to avoid my children. They will spit on the ground. This is the thing that you have done by making this decision. I will shape my child, my children, for I shall have many to bear up under this curse, to survive it. And to prevail.
Aida swept her gaze around the room, staring with her deep black eyes into the face of each of the other women in turn, then looked into the window and locked eyes with Dinah.
I pronounce it, she said,
then slowly rotated her hand until her thumb was pointed up. Dinah peeled the demolition charge away from the window. She had no idea what Aida had just said, nor did she especially care. It would be the usual histrionic Aida stuff. Several minutes remained on the countdown timer. She could have simply turned it off, but she felt like going for a walk. Whatever had just happened in the banana looked unpleasant. She was tired of being cooped up with these people, even the ones she loved. She felt no great compulsion to rejoin them. She unclipped the carabiner and let go of the lazily spinning torus. Her momentum carried her toward the wall of the crevasse. Long accustomed to movement in zero-G, she timed a slow somersault and planted her feet on the wall to kill her speed. then turned on the magnets in her boots and began hiking up the crevasse wall. The weak gravity made directions arbitrary. Walking vertically up a cliff was little different from walking horizontally along the canyon floor. A tone sounded from the speakers in her helmet, alerting her that a voice connection had been made. It was Ivy.
Going for a stroll?
Yeah.
Look, we just realized something.
Oh?
We all voted except for you.
Good point. Dinah glanced down at the countdown timer. The screen was getting more difficult to read, since she was nearing the Terminator. The knife-sharp line between sunlight and shadow, and the bright canyon wall above her was reflecting from the screen. Tilting it for a better view, she saw that it was just about to drop through the 60-second mark.
It's okay. I still have a minute to make my decision.
Well, do you want to know what the rest of us agreed on?
I trust you, but sure.
We're all going to try to have babies just like you, Dinah.
Very funny.
Dinah crossed over the Terminator and the sun rose. She raised her free hand and flipped down the sun visor on her helmet.
Moira's working on it now.
Is that why Aida was being such a drama queen about it?
Exactly. 35 seconds.
What did you really decide?
One free gene change for each mommy.
Oh yeah?
So what are you going to do? Make really smart little straight-arrow bitches? How'd you guess?
Just an intuition.
What about you, Dinah?
Dinah could hear the beginnings of anxiety in her friend's voice. She looked down into the crevasse, saw humanity's cradle welded helplessly into place. Imagined for a moment throwing the demolition charge down on it, like a vindictive goddess hurling a lightning bolt. She was thinking of Marcus. Of the kids she should have had with him. What would they have been like? Marcus had been kind of a jerk in some ways, but he knew how to control it. Really, she now understood, what had prompted her to slam the table and get up and storm out of the bananas a few minutes ago had not been Aida at all. Aida was provocative, yes, but more infuriating had been a slow burn that had started with Camilla. And her remarks about aggression. Remarks that Dinah now saw as aimed not so much at Dinah as at Marcus.
She wished she could grab Camilla by the scruff of the neck and sit her down in front of a display and make her watch the way Marcus had spent the last minutes of his life. Marcus was a hero. It seemed to Dinah that Camilla wanted to strip humanity of its heroes. She'd couched what she'd said in terms of aggression. But by doing so, Camilla was just being aggressive in a different way.
A passive-aggressive way that Dinah, raised as she'd been raised, couldn't help seeing as sneaky. More destructive in the end than the overt kind of aggression. It was this that had made her so flustered that she'd had to leave the meeting.
Dinah? Ivy said.
I'm going to breed a race of heroes, Dinah said.
Fuck Camilla.
It's going to be interesting, sharing confined spaces with a race of heroes for hundreds of years.
Marcus knew how to do it, Dinah said. He was a jerk, but he had a code. It's called chivalry.
She gave the demolition charge a toss straight up.
Did you just vote yes?
Oh, yeah, she said, watching it dwindle against the stars.
The red lights of the LED timer glittered like rubies.
We're unanimous, Ivy said.
Dinah understood that Ivy was announcing it to the other women in the banana.
For the first and last time, Dinah thought.
The red light had shrunk to a pinprick, like the planet Mars, she thought, except sharper and more brilliant. Then silently, it turned into a ball of yellow light that darkened as it spread.